Welcome to the Success in Medicine podcast. I'm Dr. Rajani Katta, author of the best-selling residency match guide, The Successful Match, and creator of the Residency Interview 101 course. This is a special series on the podcast called Energized at Work. We hear so much about burnout in medicine, and it is a real and very challenging problem. That's why I wanted to learn from doctors in all types of specialties who are the opposite of burned out. These are the doctors who are energized by work. I'm looking forward to sharing lessons and secrets from these doctors on this special series. I am very excited to be interviewing Dr. Monica Huang today. And one of the reasons I was really excited that she agreed to be interviewed is because she's had a really interesting career path. And I think she has some important lessons to share with our audience about navigating changes in your career and being really intentional about your career direction. So Dr. Huang is a diagnostic radiologist who went on to do a fellowship in body imaging. She then served in a private practice where she focused on body and breast imaging and interventions. And at that time, she was the director of ultrasound at the St. Luke's Hospital here in Houston, Texas. But her career took a little turn when she decided to go back and do a breast imaging fellowship. So she became a fellow at the MD Anderson Cancer Center. And in 2021, she founded the Department of Breast Imaging Breast Cryoablation Program. One of her great interests is that of minimally invasive breast cancer interventions. So I'm so excited to be speaking to you, Dr. Huang, today. Thank you for speaking to us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Dr. Katta. I really look forward to sharing my experience, and hopefully if it can help anyone, that'd be wonderful as well.
Well, I wanted to ask you, I just wanted to start with an overview. What does a week in the life of a diagnostic radiologist / director of breast imaging, breast cryoablation program, what does that look like?
Well, you know, usually assuming I have a cryoablation to be performed that week, for example, I start the week telephoning the patient and making sure that I answer all her questions and concerns before she even comes to the appointment. And so that I can set up expectations and allay any fears or anxiety the patient may have regarding the procedure. To me, it's always been very important, as I have always told even my trainees, that we must always keep in mind that even though I am a diagnostic imager and I really look at images most of the time, that I always keep in mind that I'm actually treating a patient. And so therefore, that would be kind of the beginning of my treatment process. I actually speak to the patient. I make sure I answer all her questions before she even arrives at the appointment for the procedure. And then once I have done that, and I, of course, then read a lot of breast imaging, I perform quite a bit of biopsies and procedures every week as well. And so although majority of time I am imaging patients, reading their imaging more, I do go into ultrasound patients, I do go into biopsy patients. So breast imaging, although it is breast imaging, we are really breast imagers and interventionalists. So because we perform biopsies, and now we also perform breast cancer and breast tumor treatments.
See, that's amazing. And I want to go a little deeper into some of the details of breast cryoablation. But before we do that, I want to share with you, Dr. Huang, that I remember taking a radiology elective when I was in medical school, and you were just sitting in this dark room the whole time. And it was kind of, drowsy inducing environment. Oh, no, but I think it's really interesting that at that time, I wasn't aware of all the different aspects that were involved in radiology, and especially what you're talking about, where you're doing ultrasound-guided biopsies. So explain a little bit about what that involves.
So I think that initially breast imaging was not exactly a subspecialty because we mostly focused on mammography, and then we started having ultrasounds and then added MRI. So imaging wise became even more complex. But as we became more and more focused on the imaging part, we also realized that once we identified the imaging abnormality, that the subspecialist, especially like a breast imager, then can really best perform that biopsy because initially, when biopsies were performed by interventional radiologists, the breast imagers then would refer the patient for biopsy by the interventionalist. But because they're not very good with breast imaging, or they are now subspecialized in breast imaging, oftentimes they actually cannot even see the abnormality we're talking about to biopsy. And oftentimes, my experience initially had been, this is in the 1990s, we would have a lot of patients come back without the biopsy, and it would be then have to be placed on some sort of follow-up. And we realized, I think, as breast imagers, that we really needed to take control of the biopsy itself because the diagnosis, needs to be made by the biopsy. And even though we may find the abnormality on imaging, if it's not a biopsied appropriately, the appropriate diagnosis was not made. So then, it became part of our practice then to not only look at the imaging, but also perform the biopsy. And now to the next level where we now have biopsied it, we know what that looks like. We know all the intricacies of the margins and what additional disease the patient may have in that breast. Then a lot of the breast imagers now, we consider ourselves interventionalists. And of course, who would be better than us to be able to treat this patient, especially we are using percutaneous techniques, minimally invasive, relying on imaging findings. So breast imagers now are not only imagers, but interventionalists, not only diagnostic interventionalists to basically diagnose the cancer, but actually now involved in the treatment.
Okay, so that's fascinating because you think about the field and then how the field is evolving over time and how you in this field are also evolving over time and having to develop new skills. And one thing I want to share that I thought was really interesting was in speaking to some of your colleagues, you're known for having a very gentle technique with your patients when you're performing, let's say, ultrasound-guided thyroid biopsies. And I thought that was really interesting because you're an imager, but here you're really very empathetic to your patients and understanding pain management. And that's not necessarily what we think of when we think of a radiologist. Like, how did all of that come about?
I think that when I've been practicing now for almost 25 years, and during the time that I have done so, I used to also perform a lot of body interventions, as you mentioned, such as thyroid biopsies, kidney biopsies, liver biopsies, lung biopsies. And I noticed that patients actually are most anxious not only about the result, but about the whole process. And as I was treating patients more and more, I realized that it was so important for the patients to be comfortable with the procedure, and that therefore, comfort during that procedure is also then the most important. So I can kind of basically be sure that the procedure, not only is it safe, but as pain-free as possible, because part of the fear is not just about, okay, the outcome, am I going to have a complication? Is this going to be cancer? But am I going to be in a great deal of pain during the procedure? And so as I kind of became more and more experienced technically, I was able then to come up with manners of injecting the lidocaine, imaging the patient while I am doing so, to be sure that I develop the appropriate, kind of procedures that I can basically perform in the best manner possible and pain-free, as much as pain-free as possible.
See, I and as a patient myself, that's incredibly important to the patient. But I feel like it wasn't always given its due by practitioners because we've got to go in and get this biopsy. We just have to get this done. So I think that's such an important recognition on your part and really speaks to your level of empathy with your patients and how much it benefits patient care.
And I think it comes back to what I tell my trainees at all times is that oftentimes, you're right, we are so focused on doing the procedure, getting the diagnosis, that forget that we are actually treating a patient and that we're not here just to treat whatever it is that we see on imaging, but that how that imaging finding eventually is going to affect this patient and how that imaging finding is perhaps going to bring on, you know, some other, you know, not only anxiety from the patient, but perhaps pain to the patient that we must also treat. And so I think that the most important is to always keep in mind that we are treating a patient, not an imaging finding. This is not just a procedure that we have to perform. And certainly your training should allow you to perform very well technically, but that we at all times are dealing with a human being, and that human being has, you know, feelings, has can feel sensations. And therefore, you know, if we kind of keep in mind the person as a whole, we then can perform actually this procedure the best possible way.
Okay, so that's a very profound lesson to be sharing with your trainees. And I wanted to ask you about something else that I know you've shared with me, that you've shared with your trainees, and that is sort of your feelings and thoughts around burnout. So I'll ask you, have you yourself ever come close to feeling burnout?
Yes, absolutely. Multiple times in my career, I did feel that I was completely burned out. And having worked through those times, I think that is what has elevated my practice, meaning when you feel completely burned out, when you work through that process by looking ahead as to not focusing only on the present time of burnout and stress and discontent, but looking forward to the future and seeing what is it that I really want to accomplish down the road is what kind of kept me going and being able to then work through that to come out and say, why am I burnt out right now? What is it about the current time that I am unhappy about? Then to be able to look for that source of happiness, source of satisfaction, and then working through that process is what re-energizes me to look forward to something new, perhaps changing my practice somehow, changing my outlook, maybe bringing into my current practice something new, something exciting, or talking to a patient and really hear them and see that what I'm doing matters. And I think that all of that has been able to kind of help me get out of my, you know, burnout, and then really give me a lot of hope and energy to keep continuing and doing what I'm doing.
Which is such a powerful message. And you were sharing with me some of the lessons that you share with your children as well around the topic of failure or of setbacks or disappointments. Can you share that with our listeners as well?
Yes. And I always tell my children that actually you should always expect that there's going to be some disappointments. There's going to be some setbacks. There's going to be failures on your part, you feel like, or failures of the system you're in. But the most important thing is actually overcoming that, because overcoming that actually gives you more strength, gives you more perspective, give you, when you talk about how did I develop empathy for all my patients and the procedures, is having, for example, maybe failed at the procedure hurt a patient. Instead of then feeling really depressed about it or upset about it, I then focus on how can I prevent that next time so that I can be a better radiologist, so I can be a better person to that patient. You know, when I get a complaint, you know, early on in my career, the patient said, you know, she didn't listen to me. She went too fast. I didn't feel valued. Then instead of going back and say, well, that patient, that was just, you know, terrible patient, whatever, I actually really took that in and kind of learned from that and said, you know what? I did not sit down and talk to this patient, did not ask the patient she understood I was talking about. It really changed the way I practiced. And so whenever I did that, then I got more and more positive reinforcement responses from my patients that made me want to do more and do better. So I think that setbacks are built into our lives. That is part so that we can grow as a radiologist, as a physician, and as a human being.
Oh, I love that message. And I love that you're sharing that with your children, because I feel like if you're on social media or even from the outside looking in at your career, Dr. Huang, I mean, you've had a very illustrious career, and you're now at the number one ranked cancer center in the United States, MD Anderson. And from the outside looking in, it's easy to see the success and to not recognize what it took to get to this point and what it continues to take, that you're constantly learning from setbacks and disappointments that continue to occur. I think that's such an important lesson for our young people.
Yes, the life is, you know, from the surface, I think we always assume everybody else's life must be better. They must be a better doctor. They must be more successful. They must be happier. But I think that the reality is that all of us have things that have happened to us, or perhaps consider even a negative or depressing or terrible sometimes. But I think to be able to really see the positive in the negative, to be able to convert something negative into a positive, that's what a successful career is built on. It's not built on, oh, nothing going wrong, the perfect trajectory. You know, as you know, Dr. Takata, I've gone through many different roles and career paths. And but every time that I've made a change, it's always brought me to a better place. And I feel that people also fear change, especially when we are caught in a rut. We feel like, okay, I'm burned out. I really can't do this anymore. A change re-energizes you to a new purpose. And whether that is something big, something small, it's really your point of view that is most important, not what somebody else's opinion is. But if you feel that you need to make that change to better your life or better your career, you should always trust your own instinct and go ahead and do it. I think that, you know, looking farther, not just at this instant, but farther away, and really seeing yourself from a bigger perspective, your career, your personal life, that is what is going to bring you, I think, joy and satisfaction.
Okay, I love that perspective. I absolutely love it. And I think when I think about your career, you were over a decade in a very busy radiology practice. You were thriving, doing extremely well. What made you decide to go from being in charge and doing extremely well to going back to do a fellowship, which involved learning from other people, taking a huge pay cut, and going in a completely, well, not a completely different direction, but a different direction? What made you do that?
You know, and that is very important. When I was in a very successful private practice, also earning financially quite a bit more, I felt that I was kind of at the end of what I wanted to do. I felt like during that practice, I have met my goals, and I was starting to feel kind of burnt out, not from the amount of work, but burnt out from doing the same things and perhaps seeing that perhaps my goals have changed and that I didn't feel that even though I was in that very successful private practice, everybody would want one, I felt that that practice was not going to bring me the kind of satisfaction and joy and that my goals had changed. It was very scary because at that time, I really was hoping I could do more research, really come up with ways to practice differently to improve patient care. But I felt that I was not going to be able to do that in that practice, but I was also afraid to leave it because it was a very successful practice. And I didn't know if I should go and do another fellowship, be a student again. Now have attendings telling me what to do when I'm the one who used to tell my trainees what to do and be a trainee again. But I kind of overcame that because I realized that since my goals have changed, I was no longer happy in my very successful private practice because I was looking farther ahead, 20 years from then, seeing myself doing the same exact things. And I really wanted to change the world a little bit, especially the world of breast imaging and breast cancer treatment. So I thought, you know, where else better to do that than at MD Anderson? And I was very fortunate to have been given this opportunity to do a fellowship to subspecialize in breast, which then allowed me to then do what I wanted to do at that point, is to perform these breast cancer treatments in a very minimally invasive manner, which I felt that was going to be very helpful to patients who have breast cancer. And if we do it appropriately in the appropriate setting with the appropriate patients, we could really bring about a significant shift in breast cancer treatment to really, I think, bring something very special, unique, and very important to the de-escalation of breast cancer treatment that we're looking at, basically doing less harm, bringing more benefits to lots of breast cancer patients.
See, that's really amazing because you founded the breast cryoablation program at MD Anderson. And so you're conducting research and you're implementing these minimally invasive treatments. And I love that this is your mission to start changing the paradigm of breast cancer treatment. Can you tell us a little bit about what breast cryoablation is and what it involves?
Sure, absolutely. Breast cryoablation is using freezing, and we're talking about very low temperatures to freeze tumors in the breast. As you know, as a dermatologist, this technique and this technology has been used for many decades to treat skin cancers, superficial skin cancers. Now, that's how everything kind of started, with cryoablation in the skin, superficial. Then these probes with a needle tip were developed to deliver this more deeply into the body. So breast is only one of the areas being treated with cryoablation. There are treatments of cancer in the lungs, in the liver, in the kidneys, for example, that use also this technology. And so right now, even though this technology has been around for decades, breast cancer cryoablation only started probably in the 1960s is the earliest that we kind of heard about it. And initially starting with skin cancer deposits. But like I said, as the technology grew, we are now able to then treat cancers located within the breast itself and treating it with this cryoprobe that we insert into the breast. Now, there are recent research publications that says that we can actually now perform curative breast cancer cryoablation in smaller tumors that have low risk, such as invasive ductal carcinomas with favorable biology. And usually about 1.5 centimeter or smaller is ideal. Now, there are also cryoablation performed for breast cancers that are larger or have metastasized, because one of the benefits of cryoablation that has been, barely studied right now is its effect on the immune response, how it incites an immune response in the body for the body to attack the tumor cells in other parts of the body. For example, we cryoablate a breast tumor, and if the patient has metastasis, let's say to the bones, to the lungs, or to the lymph node, sometimes we have seen regression of those tumors from other sites, even though we only cryoablated the breast cancer. So that is another aspect of the treatment that is very exciting, that there are trials right now looking at that specifically. So not only are we ablating the tumor in the breast and able to cure someone from the breast cancer if they have a small cancer and with certain biology, but we are hopeful that by doing so, we can help the body attack tumor cells that have spread, or come up with medications that is going to enhance that immune response to, again, attack those tumor cells elsewhere and bring about treatment response that is beyond the breast.
Okay, that is amazing. And for the types of small cancers where it might be curative, what would those patients have otherwise had to undergo in terms of treatment?
A lot of the times that we have been referred these patients, now certainly we generally, currently the standard of care for breast cancer treatment is still surgery. And oftentimes that involves surgery of the breast and lymph node and potentially added radiation or even chemotherapy, depending on what type of tumor. So if patients have elected not to have the standard of care or cannot undergo standard care because they are poor surgical candidates, then these are the kind of patients we generally will offer the cryoablation to. Now, eventually, we're hopeful that with more studies, and if the outcome continues to be excellent, that potentially for certain patients with high risk for surgery, we can then begin to offer this as their standard of care. But we are not quite there yet. So there's still a lot of studies that need to be done. But again, there's a lot of hope.
Which is really remarkable that you are, because of the clinical trials that you're performing, because of the way that you and your team are refining these techniques, this is amazing that you can start changing the treatment of breast cancer. That's what an amazing mission. Dr. Huang, what do you see as next for you in your career?
Well, what I'm hopeful is continue to do more clinical trials with breast cryoablation. But beyond that, I am also already looking forward to my next stage of making breast cancer treatment and diagnosis a bit more personalized. And that is creating an environment, a clinic that welcomes the patient, makes them feel more part of, more involved in their own care. I feel that a lot of times the clinics, especially in large institutions, including MD Anderson, not in it alone, but everywhere really, the patient shows up. And again, this goes back to my focus of the patient as a person. They show up and we kind of focus on treating their cancer. We tell them when to come, when to go, what to do. But we kind of have forgotten sometimes, again, that we are treating a person, a human being with anxiety, with perhaps fear. And so I really want to be able to create a center or an environment where the patient is treated utmost importantly as a person who can then also be involved in their own care from day one and really feel that they truly are getting a personalized treatment. So I think that even though and this all is connected because as I get more involved in treating breast cancer, I see then this need for my patients who tell me all the time how they don't feel sometimes that they are being actually cared for, like as a person, and that they are not listened to, they're not valued. And I really want to change that. So in the next step, as I become more involved in treating breast cancer and treating patients, I really want to be able to really kind of resolve some of the concerns my patients have brought to my attention about their own care. And I hope to make a difference in that arena eventually, involving everything, breast imaging, diagnostics, and therapeutics.
Okay, that is an amazing mission. it's no wonder that you feel so much satisfaction and fulfillment from the type of work that you're doing. And I'll ask you one last question, which is, I know you and I both work with a lot of early career physicians or students, and I think they're amazing. And they want to be able to shine a light in their corner of the world. And, you know, I call people like that illuminators, people who are shining a light in their corner of the world. And that's something that you've been able to do. What advice would you have for students or early career professionals who want to continue being mission driven to be able to shine that light?
What I tell them is never forget why you became a physician in the first place. I think that as we kind of move along in our careers, we apply for residency and we apply for fellowships, and we have to then, of course, think about our personal life. Sometimes we're so focused in our career that we forget that we went into this career because there is a love of something, right? Either the love of science, the love of the personal interaction, the love of being able to hold a patient's hand and guide them through difficult times. So if you can go back to that moment when you decided to be a physician and basically focus on, you know, how you can make that continually a goal and kind of involve that early, early desire to in every part of your career, I think that if you never forget that, you will always come back to that and bring the best of yourself to it. And so since I never forgot that, the reason I went into medical school and wanted to be a physician was to be able to really be there for my patient, to make a difference in their lives in whichever way I could. And as I became more proficient in my in my abilities as a physician, as a radiologist, and I then use that to see how can I make a difference in my patient's life? How can I make their lives better? And I think that once I did that, then it's not so much about, okay, I got this job that pays this much, I work this number of hours. It then became, if I do all of that, would I still be satisfying that part of myself that is helping a patient? Am I helping this patient? And I think that you will find that if you feel that you're helping a patient because that's what you wanted to do, then it doesn't really matter what you do and how you do it. As long as you feel like you are fulfilling that part of yourself that brought you to this field in the first place.
That is beautiful. That's just beautiful. And Dr. Hong, I just want to say thank you so much for being so open and for sharing your career path, and especially those final words that you're ending on. Shivers, Dr. Hong, shivers. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Kata, for giving me this opportunity to reach your audience.